Okay. Very good. I thought, first of all, we will try this bell out, check it out, see if it works nicely here. See what it sounds like. It's quite nice, isn't it? This has come all the way from Thailand, courtesy of Venerable Pun Sirivara over here. From Indonesia, isn't it? Really? Wow, okay. That's really cool. Yeah? Okay. Is this a gift to the center here? Yes? Okay. Wow. That's really nice. Very good. Okay. Okay, so let's get back to the suttas again. So we have been looking at some of the suttas that kind of look a little bit at the broader picture and also seeing how they tie in with the Noble Eightfold Path. And there's one more sutta like that, and then we kind of get down to the Noble Eightfold Path a bit more seriously after that. And this next sutta is a slightly poetic one. The idea of Buddhist poetry, and there's quite a lot of poetry in the Buddhist suttas. You know, you go to the Dhammapada is obviously poetry, the Theragata, Therigata is poetry, Udana is largely poetry. And there's a lot of poetry also in the Sanghita Nikaya, especially the first book of the Sanghita Nikaya. It's called the Saggata Vagga. Saggata means literally with verse, with poetry. So it's poetry mixed with prose, yeah, together. And lots of, and of course the idea of poetry is slightly different from the idea of prose. Prose is often used to make very clear statements about the Dhamma. Yeah, things are in a certain way. If you want to make a clear statement, prose is the best way to go because you have no restrictions on what you can say. In poetry, you have restrictions because there is a, like I was saying yesterday, you have a meter, you have a certain structure which makes a verse actually work. But the nice thing about verse is that it often is very inspiring. Yeah, it's uplifting. Yeah. So it has a slightly different purpose to it than the prose. And verse and prose, often the kind of in combination, they are very, very powerful. One side gives you a very lot of clarity about the teachings, and the other side gives you more inspiration and a feeling of, you know, wanting to do the practice, if you like. Yeah. So this one is a little bit poetic. Yeah. So that have as a kind of poetic way of describing the Noble Eightfold Path, if you like. Yeah. And this sutta is called the Brahmin, and it goes as follows. This is actually a complete sutta. Usually I just have extracts, but this actually is a complete sutta for once. At Savati, then in the morning, the Venerable Ananda, the last monk in the line here, he's called Ananda. So it's a different, slightly different Ananda. But then in the morning, the Venerable Ananda, dressed and taking bowl and robe, he entered Savati for alms. The Venerable Ananda saw the Brahmin Janusoni departing from Savati in an all-white chariot drawn by mares. The horses yoked to it were white, its ornaments were white, the chariot was white, its upholstery was white, the reins, goad, and canopy were white, his turban, clothes, and sandals were white, and he was being fanned by a white fan. People having seen this said, "Divine indeed, sir, is this vehicle. It appears to be a divine vehicle indeed, sir." So this... here we have quite a well-known character from the sutta, as the Brahmin Janusoni. He crops up everywhere in the suttas, and he was obviously a very wealthy Brahmin, and he was said to be working at the court of King Pasenadi of Kosala, who was one of the great monarchs of the time. And he lived in Savati. Savati was the capital of the famous Kosalan country. Kosalan country was a very large kingdom in the north of India. Kind of on the north bank of the river Ganges, stretching from the river Ganges all the way up to the Himalaya mountains pretty much, and also quite wide east to west. And this is where this happened. One of the famous kingdoms of early India, this particular time in India. And of course, this Brahmin Dhanusoni, being very wealthy, he would live like a wealthy person. And all of these things that you see here, these are like the characteristics of someone who was wealthy in those days. Everything would be in white. Yeah, you can see why white is a symbol of wealth, because if everything is white, you have to clean it all the time. Yeah, so you have to kind of have people to, you know, polish it and make sure it looks nice. So this is kind of, you have to be wealthy to be able to have everything in white, really. And of course, white also in Buddhism in those days is also a symbol of purity. Yeah, when people come, some of you are wearing all white here, which is really nice. If you, you know, in Buddhist countries, very often people wear white on the Uposatha days. The Uposatha days are the days of the full moon and the new moon. People keep the 8 precepts, they come to hear a Dhamma talk, and they wear white as a symbol of purity. It's very beautiful when you see that. I remember when I was in Sri Lanka a few years ago, I gave a talk in a very large auditorium in Colombo. And there was something almost like 1,500 people present or something for that talk. And everyone wore white. Yeah, absolutely. I think I didn't see anyone, I think, in that auditorium who wasn't wearing white, except for myself. I wasn't wearing white, but everyone else was wearing white. And it's very beautiful, this kind of large sea of people in front of you. And you get this feeling of everybody being committed to something specific. And of course, what they were doing, I hope so anyway, they were keeping the 8 precepts on the course of that day, and they were coming to listen to a Dhamma talk. It was actually it's very beautiful when you see that. So white is a symbol of purity, and that's probably one of the reasons why this Brahmin was wearing white as well. He wanted to be looked upon as a kind of pure person, not some kind of corrupt official. I think he probably was a fairly good person because he had a keen interest in the Dhamma and all of these things. In the Western culture, we have the idea of a candidate, and the candidate apparently. Candid is the Latin word for white. So the idea of candidate goes back to the Roman times. When you were standing for the Senate in Rome, you would wear white as a symbol of purity. Yeah, I'm not sure how pure those people were, but that's kind of was the idea anyway. You're supposed to kind of look pure at the very least, pretend to be pure, whatever. So this is the divine vehicle. And then we come to the Dhamma part of this. Then, when the Venerable Ananda had walked for alms in Savatthi and returned from his alms round, after his meal he approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said to him, "Here, Venerable Sir, in the morning I dressed, and taking bowl and robe, I entered Savatthi for alms. I saw the Brahmin Dhanusoni departing from Savatthi in an all-white chariot drawn by mares." And then all of this other stuff. And people, having seen this, said, "Divine indeed, sir, is the vehicle. It appears to be a divine vehicle indeed, sir. Is it possible, Venerable Sir, to point out a divine vehicle in this Dhamma and training, this teaching and training?" Dhamma and discipline. This is a Dhamma Vinaya. In Pali, Vinaya means like the training. And Dhamma, of course, is the teaching. Yeah, the teaching, in other words, theory and practice, if you like. "It is possible," Ananda, the Blessed One, said. "This is a designation for the Noble Eightfold Path, the divine vehicle, and the vehicle of Dhamma, and the unsurpassed victory in battle." So these are terms the Buddha uses to describe the Noble Eightfold Path, a divine vehicle. Yeah, so if you're practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, you are practicing the divine vehicle. Sounds nice, yeah? Isn't that kind of inspiring? You're on the divine vehicle if you're practicing this path properly. Why is it divine? Well, it is divine for a number of reasons. Of course, it is divine because it leads to happiness from the very beginning. I remember one of the epithets, one of the qualities the Buddha uses to talk about the Dhamma. He calls it, it is happy in the beginning, happy in the middle, and happy in the end. From the very beginning, you start to get good results by practicing the Dhamma. It is divine in that sense from the very beginning. Yeah, and it leads to gradually to more and more happiness. But as the higher you go on this path, and especially when you get to right stillness, the Samma Samadhi and the Jhanas at the very end of the path, it is literally divine. The Pali word for divine here is Brahma. Yeah, Brahma being kind of the god of the ancient Brahmanical system. And of course, in Buddhism, that refers to the idea of the Brahma Viharas, the dwelling, living like Brahma, the Metta, the Karuna, the Mudita, and the Upeka, the four Brahma Viharas. When you get to the jhanas, that is where you get to that point on the Buddhist path where you actually are in tune with that, those Brahma realms, those high realms of metta, of compassion and all that. So this path, when it is practiced fully, actually you do experience those realms here, right here, in the present here and now. You take part in those realms. You feel like you are in those realms. Mentally, you're already there when you practice this path fully. So it is a divine vehicle in that sense. Yeah, and actually, it's quite an inspiring term when you think about it. The Brahma Yana. Yana means vehicle. Yeah, you have the like the Vajrayana, Mahayana, all of those yana at the end means vehicle. Hinayana is sometimes used. Yana is the vehicle. Here it's called the Brahmayana, the divine vehicle. The vehicle of Dhamma, yeah, the Dhammayana is what is used here. In other words, it is the Dhamma really is a vehicle. The Dhamma is a vehicle from taking us from our present state of affairs to a much better state of affairs, taking us away from suffering towards more happiness. This is what the Dhamma Yana is all about. This is the whole purpose of Dhamma. It has no other purpose apart from that. So in a sense, the Dhamma is a vehicle. It is a movement in a very positive direction to give you everything you ever wanted in your life. The unsurpassed victory in battle. And this is where the Dhamma and the Noble Eightfold Path becomes like completely internalized, and where it becomes completely part of who you are. It is where it leads to the victory in battle, the victory over the defilements, the victory over suffering, and then coming out the other end and achieving the highest happiness that is possible for any living being. This is what the Dhamma is about, achieving quite literally the highest happiness. And that when you get to that other end, then you have achieved that unsurpassed victory in battle. Anuttara Sangama Vijayo, or something like that, is the Pali term behind that. And that is what, again, the Noble Eightfold Path is about. Yeah? Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Yeah, would you like some of this stuff? Yeah? It's great. This is the whole point of it. When you see these things, when it's used in a poetic way, it actually draws out another aspect of these things. It makes it very attractive when you think about it in the right way. And it makes you gets you going on the path. Then the Buddha says, right view, Ananda, when developed and cultivated, has as its final goal the removal of desire, the removal of ill will, and the removal of confusion. And then the same thing for all the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right stillness, when developed and cultivated, have as the final goal the removal of desire, the removal of ill will, and the removal of confusion. Yeah, or delusion, you can maybe say here as well. So, in other words, this is how he's describing why it is worthy of those epithets that he has just mentioned. In this way, Ananda, it may be understood how this is a designation for the Noble Eightfold Path, the divine vehicle, the vehicle of Dhamma, and the unsurpassed victory in battle. This is one of those strange things about the Buddhist teachings. We talk about the removal of desire, of ill will and delusion, and it doesn't sound all that kind of inspiring, perhaps. Yeah, okay, yes, you remove that, then what? Kind of, does that mean, what do you feel then? Do you feel kind of really bland? Do you feel really bored? What happens? It doesn't sound very kind of exciting. Yes, you take away desire, you take away ill will. It's kind of, what then? But of course, remember, the point is that when you remove these defilements, the opposite qualities come forth. That is what is so important to remember here. Yeah, it is not just a bland state where kind of you feel like nothing afterwards. The point is that when you remove ill will, you actually have lots of metta. You have lots of kindness for people around. You have tremendous compassion for the world. You understand the predicament they're in. When you remove desire, you become very, you find happiness in completely different places. You find happiness in the joys of samadhi and all of these kind of things. It is far better than having desire. Desire is a problem. You find real happiness through that. When you remove delusion, you become wise. Yeah, you understand what is really worthwhile pursuing in life, what matters, what is just a kind of a veil and a delusion and not really real in the sense of giving you sustained and profound happiness. So remember, when you see the negative terms, the positive applies at the same time. These are just two sides of the same coin. It's important to remember that, otherwise it doesn't sound all that, yes, okay, you remove ill will, then what? It doesn't maybe not sound all that interesting as such. But of course, the point is that it is. Then we have these little verses at the bottom here where the Buddha reinforces the idea of what the Noble Eightfold Path is all about. This is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Fortunate One, the Teacher, the Fortunate One is the Sugato, the Teacher, the Sutta, further said this. Its qualities of faith and wisdom are always yoked evenly together. Shame is its pole, mind its yoke tie, mindfulness the watchful charioteer. The chariot's ornament is virtue, its axle, jhana, energy, its wheels. Equanimity keeps the burden balanced, desirelessness serves as upholstery. Goodwill, harmlessness, and seclusion, these are the chariot's weaponry. Forbearance, its armor and shield, as it rolls towards the security from bondage. This divine vehicle, unsurpassed, originates from within oneself. The wise depart from the world in it, inevitably winning the victory. These are then the verses spoken by the Buddha, and I'm going to try to draw out a little bit of the meaning here of what actually this the ideas behind this is. And the first thing is to recognize some of the shortcomings sometimes of the translation that is given. So its qualities of faith and wisdom are always yoked evenly together. I don't know why Bhikkhu Bodhi has put evenly in there, because there's nothing in the Pali that suggests evenly. So I would have translated this as something like the yoke is the qualities of faith and wisdom always bound together. Yeah, so the yoke here, the yoke is that, you know, you have this would be a kind of a typical chariot where you have two horses or perhaps two oxen, depending on whether it's an ox chariot or a horse chariot. And they would be bound together by a yoke which holds the animals together and binds them to the carriage. Yeah, and here those two horses, because we are talking about the horse chariot, those two horses here, they are what is meant by wisdom and faith. So the power of the chariot, the thing that empowers it, the engine of the Noble Eightfold Path, the engine of the chariot is wisdom and faith. This is what allows you to move forward. And this is very similar to the Noble Eightfold Path. You have right view and you have right intention, yeah? Wisdom and faith, or if you like, confidence and wisdom. This is where that is found on the Noble Eightfold Path. So the more you have of right view, the more you have of that wisdom quality, the more you have of confidence, the more you are enabling the Noble Eightfold Path. That's why a right view is at the very beginning, at the very start. Once you get right view, I shouldn't say get it sorted out, because it doesn't really work like that. It's a gradual movement towards right view, a gradual strengthening of the right view. The more you strengthen that, the more you are building up the foundations of the Noble Eightfold Path, enabling you to actually do the practice. Right view is the engine. Once the engine is going, the vehicle has to go as a consequence. These things happen almost automatically. And one of the interesting points here, and this is kind of quite unique, I think, to the Buddhist teachings, is that faith, saddha in Pali, and wisdom, panya, always go together. These are not opposed qualities in the Buddhist teachings. Yeah? So the more wisdom you have, in other words, the more insight you have into these teachings, that the better you have practiced the path, the less defilements you have, and all of these kind of things, the more faith you have. Wisdom leads to more faith. Wisdom leads to more confidence. And the more confidence you have, the more wisdom you tend to have, because you then act accordingly, and it gives rise to real insight. So in Buddhism, these two are conjoined qualities, wisdom and faith. They are not separate. Yeah, and this is kind of very interesting, because it gives you an idea that in Buddhism, faith is not an affair which has to do with being blind. You just believe because it's good to believe. No, faith actually comes out of right view. It comes out of a wisdom to start with. That is where that faith and that confidence actually come from. They are conjoined to each other. They are part and parcel of the same kind of outlook. Yeah, this is very, very useful. So why do we use these two words? And the reason why we use two words like saddha and panya is because confidence is kind of more basic. You start out with that confidence. It's like a preliminary wisdom, if you like, because you are able to see the beauty of the Dhamma, able to see that the Dhamma actually will get you somewhere. And gradually that preliminary wisdom, preliminary outlook, transforms into real understanding and a real experiential insight into reality, into things. And then your confidence becomes confirmed, it becomes stable, it becomes real confidence and real faith that is no longer challengeable. It is kind of unchallengeable, basically, because you have seen these things for yourself. But one of the nice things about the word faith, and this is one of the things that, you know, you see in the suttas as well, if you use the word wisdom, it may sound perhaps a bit dry. Yeah, you're wise, you kind of have an understanding of things. But the beautiful thing about the word faith is that faith or confidence has two aspects to it. The confidence is an intellectual assent to the teachings. Yeah, you have confidence that these teachings are correct. But the idea of faith is also an emotion. Yeah, if you have faith in something, it means you feel inspired by those teachings. You feel uplifted by them. You read the Dhamma and you feel, yay, this is really good stuff. And you feel so inspired by this. You feel uplifted. You may feel a sense of joy. So faith has this emotional component, and this is a very important part of this. And this is why the Buddha sometimes uses poetry to lift up our spirits. This is why the Buddha recommends things like contemplating the Dhamma, because it lifts you up, and it actually enables you, it empowers your practice, precisely because of that emotional component of the Dhamma. So faith and wisdom are two important things that they go together in that sense, that there is the understanding side and there is the emotional side. And when those things come together, that is when it becomes very powerful. When I talk about emotion here, I mean emotion in the sense of these very positive emotions. Yeah, when you sit down and you start to feel joy in your meditation practice, that's what I'm talking about. And many, many of you will know what this means, because you will have had these experiences in your meditation already. It's very, very positive force in your mind when these things start to arise. So this is the engine that allows the Dhamma to take off. That's why it is at the very beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path. It shows you the way. When that confidence and faith is there, then the practice happens automatically, yeah? Because you know this is what you need to do. Just like the draught animals are the thing that drives it forward, drives the carriage forward, in the same way, these are the qualities that drive the Noble Eightfold Path forward. And then it says these are always bound together. Yeah, not evenly necessarily, but they're always bound together. So this is the yoke with the animals. And then it says that shame is its pole, mind its yoke tie. I'm not sure exactly what the yoke tie is, but I think it is possibly the thing which ties the pole. Look at the yoke is the thing which binds the animals together. The pole is what ties to the yoke and ties the chariot to the yoke. Yeah, so the chariot is bound to the animal. That's the pole. And then the yoke tie might be the thing which binds the pole to the yoke, perhaps something like that. I'm not entirely sure what this means. I'm no expert in this ancient chariot, so I'm not exactly sure how this works. But shame is the pole, yeah? And the idea is that when you have wisdom, when you have faith, you understand the importance of living well. And you feel a sense of shame. You feel a sense of, you feel bad about things when you do things that are bad. Yeah, you feel a sense, you feel that you haven't lived up to your own personal standards. You know that you are dragging yourself towards some suffering in life. Yeah, and because you know that, because that's what where your faith and your wisdom is, you avoid that. So this is what binds together the chariot to the engine in front. Once you have that understanding, the shame, the fear of the consequences of what you're doing, holds this whole chariot together and drives you forward. Mind is the yoke tie. I don't know what that means, so I can't, unfortunately, I can't really comment so much on that one. Mindfulness is the watchful charioteer. Yeah, the charioteer sitting on the chariot, holding the reins, steering the animals in the right way, so you're heading in the right direction. So you already have the wisdom there, and now mindfulness has to ensure that you're driving in the right direction. Mindfulness is what informs you of what you're doing now, whether it is right or wrong, whether it's appropriate or not. In the sutta, this is often called sampajanya. Sampajanya, often translated as full awareness or clear comprehension. It goes together with mindfulness. It's the ability, first of all, to be aware, you know what's going on, and then to know whether what you're doing is appropriate or not for the task at hand. The task at hand here is to drive the chariot towards Nibbana. That's the task. What I'm doing now, am I going in the direction of Nibbana or am I going in some other bad direction? What is the opposite of Nibbana? Maybe Mara's realm or something like that. So you ensure that is the charioteer's job, to drive you in the right direction. So that's what mindfulness is about. And sometimes mindfulness in the suttas is called the Adipati. Adipati means like the Lord, yeah? It is the ruler, because mindfulness, in a sense, if you have real mindfulness, mindfulness steers your life, it rules your life. It enables you to choose the right path and the wrong path. If you have no mindfulness, it's like you're walking around in a cloud. You don't really know if you're going here or there. The more clarity you have, the more ability you have to steer your life in the right direction, yeah? And this is kind of the point here. So when wisdom and mindfulness comes together, mindfulness gives you the awareness of what is going on. Wisdom gives you the ability to know whether you're heading in the right direction or not. The two coming together is very powerful. That's why mindfulness is called this ruler in your life. It rules our life. It enables us to head either in the right or the wrong direction. So this is what watchful charioteer is all about. And then it says the chariot's ornament is virtue. And I think, personally, I think that's a terrible translation, because virtue is not an ornament. It sounds like it's something that you can cast off. It doesn't really matter. It's just there for beauty or whatever. But that's not the point. The Pali word here is parikara, and parikara really means equipment. Yeah, virtue is an integral part of the Noble Eightfold Path. It is the equipment that allows you to reach samadhi, that allows you to be mindful. Without virtue, the path doesn't work anymore. It is absolutely important. To say it's an ornament to me completely misses the point. It is an equipment that enables the path to go forward. Yeah, and without that virtue, nothing really happens. It's one of the interesting things when you read the suttas, you see how important and basic the idea of kindness, compassion, virtue, morality, living well, how it is the foundation for everything else on the Buddhist path. So it's important to get these things the right way. I don't really understand why Venerable Bodhi translates the ornament here, because everywhere else he translates parikara as equipment or requisite or something like that. It's a bit of a mystery to me. Anyway, Its axle is jhana, its energy is its wheels. Yeah, and again, quite interesting, the idea that the axle is jhana, the axle and the wheels obviously are very closely related to each other. Yeah, they are bound together. If you have the axle, you will have the wheels normally. If you have jhana, you always have energy. Energy always comes along with samadhi. You cannot really have samadhi without energy. So this is what enables, that this is what gives gives the ability for the chariot to move forward at speed. Yeah, without wheels or axle, you're just going to sit there on the ground. The horses are going to pull as hard as they can, and you're barely going to budge because you can't build up any speed if you don't have any wheels on this chariot. So this is what enables a chariot to move forward at speed to get you to the destination. Otherwise, you're never going to get there. Huh? Yeah, and it shows you the significance, the importance of samadhi on the Buddhist path, of jhana on the Buddhist path. Without it, there is no, there is missing that power of the mind that gives you the speed, gives you the force, gives you the energy to actually be able to reach the goal. Samadhi is essential for the path. Equanimity keeps the burden balanced. If you don't have equanimity, it means you keep on moving to one side or the other one. You attach to one thing, then to another one. You desire here, you desire there. Equanimity keeps you in the balance all the way through, not really getting too excited about anything. The Pali here also means, quite interesting, it also has a double meaning. It also means that equanimity is the foremost samadhi, is an alternative translation to that one. So, which of course is true, because equanimity is like the fourth jhana, the highest samadhi on the path. Desirelessness serves as upholstery. And again, I don't think this quite gets to the point, because I'm not sure how desirelessness is the upholstery. Rather, it is the covering of the chariot. Yeah, it is the covering. And because a chariot might have a covering, you sit inside it. And the idea is that if you want to keep the chariot clean from dust and rain and external elements, you have to have a covering. Otherwise, all these defilements come inside. And again, desirelessness is like this ability to keep the defilements out. Yeah. So the desirelessness is the covering of the chariot that keeps it, keeps the defilements and keep the dirt and keep all the problems out. Goodwill, harmlessness, and seclusion. Yeah, this is goodwill here. Avyapada, harmlessness, ahimsa, and seclusion here. Viveka. So these are like the three kind of good qualities of mind. These are the chariot's weaponry. Yeah, this is kind of the one of those beautiful ideas in the Dhamma, that the weapons that we have. And weapons here, what is it that we are defending against? What we are defending against is the defilements. What we are defending against is all the difficulties in life. Yeah, when you are coming to the company with a person you find difficult to be around, someone you have always had difficulties with, or you have some kind of hardship in your life, what are the weaponry to be able to deal with that? And in Buddhism, the weaponry is always these very positive things, the idea of goodwill. In other words, metta, karuna, harmlessness, is the opposite of being harsh and cruel. In other words, it is the idea of having compassion for people. Yeah, and finally, seclusion. It's like coming here to Jhana Grove for a while and kind of being a bit secluded from your ordinary life, coming away from that. That is the weaponry. That is what stops the defilements from arising. That is what enables you to deal with the world in the right way whenever you have difficulties and problems. So, yeah, it's very kind of very attractive, isn't it? The weaponry, it's, you reverse the whole idea of weaponry to being something very positive instead. This is how you protect yourself, basically, yeah, the weaponry you have. Forbearance is your armor and shield. Forbearance means that you are patient, you are able to bear with things. When other people are difficult or life gets difficult, you are able to deal with it because you have this understanding that allows you to be patient and bear whatever is happening here. And this is as it rolls towards the security from bondage. The security from bondage is nibbana, it is awakening. Yeah, security from bondage, yoga, kema. Yoga means binding, kema means like liberation from the binding, being bound to the world, bound to samsara, bound to suffering. That is where you're heading, liberation from all of that. And this is this chariot. So when you look at that chariot there, you can see, if you look carefully, all the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path are there. You have the energy, which is like the effort. You have the jhanas, which is the samadhi, the last factor. The mindfulness is there. The virtue is there. And then the wisdom, right view at the beginning here. So this is that Noble Eightfold Path, yeah, which is the divine vehicle. This is how it works. This divine vehicle, unsurpassed, originates from within oneself. Yeah, it is an internal vehicle. It is the it's a psychological vehicle that you practice. And so that it's all inside of us. The Eightfold Path is an inner path. It's a part of who you are as a person. And the wise depart from the world in it, inevitably winning the victory here. The victory here being the victory over suffering, the victory over problems, the victory of achieving happiness in the world. So, there you are. That is the Noble Eightfold Path in poetic terms. The problem with translating poetry, it's very hard to translate poetry in a way that it becomes really inspiring. In the original Pali, it would have been very inspiring because it would have had a nice rhythm. It would have kind of, you know, sounded very good. In English, you always have to compromise. You have to ask yourself, should I translate the meaning correct? Or should we translate it into a kind of nice sounding poetry? And it's very difficult to make it into as inspiring and as meaningful as the original. So you always lose a few things in translation, unfortunately. But if I read it out in Pali, you probably wouldn't be all that wise afterwards. So it's still useful to have a bit of translation. So, there you are. So, now we have looked at some of the preliminary suttas. And we had a look at all these beautiful similes of the Buddha, seeing the Noble Eightfold Path as the path in the jungle that leads to this beautiful city. That's what the Noble Eightfold Path is like. It's like a chariot that you drive towards Nibbana. Yeah, the Noble Eightfold Path is like the raft that you use to cross the river. All of these beautiful similes for the Noble Eightfold Path. And now we want to get into trying to understand how it actually works. And this is what the rest of this retreat is going to be about, looking at this Noble Eightfold Path in detail and drawing out all the implications on how it is practiced. And the next sutta is an overview of the entire path, and I will spend a bit of time explaining how this works. This is the first sutta in the Magga Sanyutta. Magga Sanyutta is the connected discourses on the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the very first one. So it sets the scene for how one should understand the Noble Eightfold Path. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There the Blessed One addressed the monks thus. Monks, venerable sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this: ignorance is the forerunner in the entry upon unwholesome qualities, with shamelessness and fearlessness of wrongdoing following along. For an unwise person immersed in ignorance, wrong view springs up. For one of wrong view, wrong intention springs up. For one of wrong intention, wrong speech springs up. For one of wrong speech, wrong action springs up. For one of wrong action, wrong livelihood springs up. For one of wrong livelihood, wrong effort springs up. For one of wrong effort, wrong mindfulness springs up. And for one of wrong mindfulness, wrong stillness springs up. And then, of course, you have also the exact reverse. Yeah, the reverse is when you start off with a true knowledge or insight, then the whole reverse thing happens as a consequence, and you end up with right stillness at the very end. I'll come back to that last paragraph later on. So this is how the Buddha explains the Noble Eightfold Path. And there is a number of things here that is very interesting about this. And one of the things that is very, I think, important about this is what you will see again is the quality, how it is sequential, how one thing leads to the next one. It's a causal sequence. It is not just a random accumulation of eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. They have a particular sequence where each one leads on to the next one. And this is one of the things I was mentioning yesterday about how the Dhamma is always structured very beautifully, how nothing is random. When you have the five khandhas, for example, it's always the same sequence. Rupa, form, then Vedana, feeling, then Sanya, perception, then Sankara, will, and then Vijnana, consciousness at the very end. Always the same sequence. Five hindrances, same sequence. Six sense pairs, the same sequence. Dependent origination, same sequence. Everything is always the same sequence. And the reason for that is because the sequence matters. And the sequence can be, for example, it can be a sequence where it starts with the more important, starts with the more significant thing, yeah, or the most basic thing, if you like, the thing that you have to deal with first, and then moves on to more refined things. Yeah, that's one way that the sequence works. Or the sequence can be, as it is here, a causal sequence where one thing actually leads to the next one, where there is a direct link between these factors. And this is very common in the suttas. I was mentioning the seven factors of awakening before. That is a causal sequence. Dependent origination obviously is a causal sequence. Yeah, five faculties is a causal sequence. And this is very important because once you understand that something is a causal sequence, it becomes much more clearer what you have to do. So when we are here dealing with the Noble Eightfold Path, because it is a causal sequence, it means that right view, the very first one, is actually very significant. Yeah, because once right view is in place, the other things tend to happen as a matter of course. This is what causality means, that once the first aspect of causality is in place, everything else happens as a consequence of that. If you haven't got right view, if you haven't got the very first one, nothing is going to happen. Yeah, you're going to come and get stuck at the very start. If you start off with the wrong view, everything else goes wrong on the path. And this is what this is saying here. Start off with the wrong view, everything else becomes wrong as well, and you can't really get anywhere. So a lot of the emphasis on the Buddhist path would be to get the view right. Yeah, and as you practice these teachings, as you do your meditation practice, as you live a life of kindness and compassion, you keep on reflecting on this, on these teachings to strengthen that right view all the time. Right view in Buddhism is not something that either you have it or you don't have it. It's either, yeah, I consent to the Buddha's teaching, okay, now I have a right view, what's next? It isn't really like that. Right view is something that you develop gradually over time. You ask yourself, what are the implications of these teachings? Yeah, traditionally, people talk about right view in Buddhism being like, understand, having an acceptance of rebirth and karma. But even, and there's much more to it than that, but if you start with that, what does it mean to accept the idea of rebirth? And one thing is just to say, yes, I believe in rebirth. Maybe you have been born in a culture where the rebirth comes with the culture, yeah? But it's just like a cultural inheritance that you have got. But it doesn't mean that you have any real deep appreciation of the idea. So you ask yourself, what does it mean when there is rebirth? What are the implications of this? What are the implications of the laws of karma? What does it mean for me personally? And once you start to understand what these things actually mean, that is where they become powerful, because they actually give you, again, this emotional resource, the emotions that drive you forward on the Buddhist path. Yeah, it is we are driven by emotions. This is what it's like to be a human being. That's why we have desires. Desires are always about kind of getting what we want one way or another. This is emotional things. We are emotional beings. So emotions are so important to get those things right at the beginning here. And then these things work out. So remember, right view is a gradual thing that you develop gradually over time, more and more. It's not just an assent to a certain number of principles and you say, aye, aye, sir, I assent to that. It's not as simple as that. It is a gradual development. And this is the first thing to understand about this path, the importance of this causality of the Noble Eightfold Path. And then, so we will spend quite a bit of time looking at right view for that reason, to make sure we give that a maximum chance to kind of to sink in and consider that. And then you have the whole sequence coming as a function of that, ending up in the negative sequence here, ending up with wrong stillness. Yeah? In the positive sequence, it ends up with right stillness if you have a right view. And this is one of those interesting things about the Buddhist path, is that it ends up with samadhi. Samadhi is the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. So what happened to wisdom? Aren't we supposed to become wise? Aren't we supposed to kind of see things as they actually are? How come samadhi is at the very end of this path? And the reason for that is because what we do, this is the path is about what we do, is about what we practice. And once you come to right stillness at the end of the path, that stillness is called right if it is imbued with right view from the very beginning. So if it is wrong stillness, it means that it is imbued with wrong view. Stillness imbued with wrong view is wrong stillness. Stillness imbued with right view, yeah, is right stillness. Once you have that, what you have is that you have the fuel and you have the flame coming together. The fuel and the flame here is a right view and right stillness coming together. And that's where you have the possibility of gaining insight because those two are there. And then things can really happen and you can get this massive renewed understanding of what life and what the world actually is about. So the path goes to right stillness and then the rest is pretty much automatic because you are starting off with right view anyway. Yeah, but it's fascinating how the Noble Eightfold Path actually ends with that, and it doesn't really go beyond the right stillness. Of course, in other places in the suttas, it shows you what happens afterwards. You gain the right stillness, it talks about the insights you get and all of that, but it is largely automatic. So, let us have a look at this process in a little bit more detail. Ignorance, yeah, ignorance here is avidya. Avidya is exactly the same word as you have at the beginning of dependent origination. I prefer delusion as a translation because ignorance to me doesn't quite hit the mark. Ignorance often means that you are ignorant of facts, but this has got nothing to do with facts. This has to do, well, a little bit to do with facts, but not that much. It has mostly to do with your outlook on the world, if you have the right outlook or not. Do you, things like non-self and all of these kind of things. So if you are, the more deluded you are, yeah, the more that means that you enter upon unwholesome qualities. And these unwholesome qualities are all of the things that follow afterwards, wrong morality and all of these kind of things. And with shamelessness and fearlessness of wrongdoing following along. And this is the problem if you are very deluded, yeah, if you are, don't really understand the importance of morality, if you don't understand the connection between the goodness in your life and happiness, both for yourself and for others, if you don't understand that connection, and that is a very important part of delusion, you're going to act immorally. You're not going to act with kindness. You're not going to be generous because you're unable to see that connection between the two. Yeah, and this is, to me, and I think for people who have been Buddhist for a long time and practiced this path for a long time, the connection between how we live, the intentions that we have in our life, and how we experience life, actually, it becomes very obvious after a while. Yeah, and this is I mentioned this yesterday. The connection between your intention towards others, whether you are kind or not, and how you feel about yourself. And I'm sure most of you here will agree that if you look into yourself, it's very obvious that there's a very strong connection there. If you do something which isn't quite nice, you tend to feel bad about yourself afterwards. If you do something kind towards others, you tend to feel good about yourself afterwards. And that's really all there's to it. Yeah, and once you understand that, you get a fear. You start to get a slight fear of doing what is wrong, because you know that you are dragging yourself down. You know the consequences of this is to destroy your own happiness. Who wants to destroy their own happiness? It's crazy to destroy your own happiness. Everybody wants to be happy. Yeah, so once you get that, you get this sense of fear of wrongdoing, because you know the consequences of wrongdoing actually are very severe. For yourself and also for the people around you. And you also get a sense of shame. Yeah, what if some very wise person saw you doing something bad? You would feel bad about yourself. Yeah, someone you really respect because they are wise. And they see you doing something dodgy. Yeah, I hope please don't do anything dodgy. But yeah, they see there's something which isn't quite right. And you feel a little bit ashamed of that. You don't want other people to know, yeah? Especially not the people who are your friends in the spiritual life, the people you consider wise. You feel slightly ashamed of that. And the shame is there's two kinds of shame. One is what you call socially sanctioned shame. In other words, shame because you don't want other people to know about it. But also there's like a personal shame as well, where you feel kind of unworthy of your acts. You feel that you are really better than that. Yeah, you don't really want to think of yourself in that way. You feel slightly personally ashamed of what you have done, because you know this is wrong. This is not appropriate. And when these things come together, they actually become very powerful forces on the Buddhist path. So sometimes in our society, we kind of discourage people from feeling shame, but it depends on what kind of shame it is. In Buddhism, some degree of shame is a positive thing. If it is a type of shame that drives you forward to be kind and a good person, it has a positive effect. There are types of shame that are completely useless, that are just to do with how society judges us, or other people judges us, that has nothing to do with morality. That sort of stuff is pointless. But the kind of shame where you feel slightly wrong about having done something that is inappropriate, it is a positive factor of the Buddhist path. So keep that in mind, yeah? Feeling a bit ashamed of doing something bad actually probably is a good thing, because it keeps you on the right track. So you start off with this ignorance, and because of that, you don't really have any shame, you don't feel any wrongdoing, because you grew up in a mafia family and they told you that doing bad is really good. Yeah, so you do all this bad stuff. And then, of course, all of these bad things happen as a consequence. Bad intentions, bad morality, bad effort, and all of that. So let us look at the reverse side. And the reverse side is as follows. True knowledge, this is vidya, or insight, if you like, is the forerunner in the entry upon wholesome qualities, with a sense of shame and fear of wrongdoing following along. For a wise person who has arrived at true knowledge, right view springs up. For one of right view, right intention springs up. For one of right intention, right speech springs up. For one of right speech, right action springs up. For one of right action, right livelihood springs up. For one of right livelihood, right effort springs up. For one of right effort, right mindfulness springs up. And for one of right mindfulness, right stillness springs up. Somebody suggested immersion for samadhi. So you can have right immersion or right stillness at the end, at the very last one there. We can discuss the best translation maybe later on. I haven't got enough time to do that now, but maybe we can discuss that later on, what is an appropriate translation for these words. So here, true knowledge, yeah, I think insight is a good one, a good translation. Vidya, the opposite of delusion. Delusion means you're walking around in darkness, not knowing what is going on. Insight is like seeing clearly what is going on. The light's being turned on. Now you understand what is actually how the world works. You understand that there is a problem with being immoral. You understand that there are good reasons for living a good life of kindness and compassion. All of these things become clear for you. And as a consequence, you get this sense of shame and a fear of wrongdoing, because you understand that the consequences of wrongdoing are very severe. But it's not just a negative thing that you are afraid of wrongdoing, but actually you are encouraged to do what is good. And this is one of the things that I always found very inspiring on the Buddhist path, and we will see more of this later on, is that morality in Buddhism is not just about avoiding the bad stuff. It's about deliberately doing the good things. Yeah, deliberately trying to be kind, deliberately supporting others, deliberately saying kind words, deliberately thinking kind thoughts. Yeah, so, and this is kind of unusual. You don't find very many moral teachings that actually emphasize the positive side of things, but in Buddhism we do. By avoiding doing the bad stuff, you avoid having a bad conscience and thinking bad things about yourself. By doing the good things, you actually positively feel good about yourself. You feel, yay, yeah, I'm doing the right thing, I'm living well. And that becomes, again, a force in your meditation practice. So, you have the insight, and of course part of that insight is that you have this true knowledge, you have right view. Yeah, you have the right understanding, the right outlook on things. And right view has many different degrees with it, of it, and we're going to have a look at all those various degrees later on. Once you have that right view, you see the world in the right way, you understand the dangers in immorality, you understand principles like rebirth and karma, you understand all of these other things, impermanence, non-self to some extent, where suffering and happiness lies. You understand about, an aspect of rebirth is, for example, how we deal with our parents, our understanding of generosity, and all of these things are aspects of right view. The more you have of that, right intention springs up. And right intention, one way of translating that is as a right aim, right purpose in life. Your purpose becomes clear. Your aim becomes clear. You know what you have to do. You know where you want to go. Yeah, because right view clarifies what you are living for. This is what gives life meaning. And suddenly, if your life has meaning, the purpose becomes clear. You know what you are doing now. Ajahn Brahm likes to translate this factor as right motivation. And that's also an interesting translation. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. But personally, I prefer right aim and right purpose. It depends a little bit on how far you have gone on the path, whether right motivation or right aim is superior. But I personally prefer right purpose here. So your right view, your purpose comes into view, and you start to see what you are living for. You start to see how you're supposed to achieve that. Once the purpose has become right, the aim has become right, the first aspect of that aim is to live well, yeah, to be kind, right speech, right action, right livelihood. This all has to do with morality, living in the right way. Once you live in the right way, then you come to right effort. Right effort is the refinement of living well, also coming to the mind. Clearing out the mind, clearing out some of the coarser defilements, making the mind more positive, having more metta, having more compassion. This is what right effort is all about. Then comes the right mindfulness. The right mindfulness is where meditation starts. The very last defilements and problems in the mind get kind of sorted out. And when they get sorted out, eventually, this is through satipatthana and right mindfulness, that is where right, real deep meditation becomes possible, because all of those defilements have been left behind. That is where you get to sammasamadhi. You can see here this beautiful path, a path of purification. Yeah, the path where you gradually purify yourself. You get the right aim, you understand that to purify yourself is really the whole purpose of life. And you have this beautiful gradual way of purifying your mind until eventually you reach the highest purity and you come to right stillness. And that is where real insight becomes possible. Yeah, the Visuddhi Magga. Yeah, that famous work written by the very famous monk Buddhaghosa about 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha. He wrote a book called the Visuddhimagga, but really it is the Noble Eightfold Path which is the Visuddhimagga. That is the path to purity, the path of purification that takes you to all of these positive things and all the way to the end of the path itself. Okay, so that is all for this morning. Please keep on enjoying yourself. Have a nice lunch down the line, and we'll see you back again at 3 o'clock here.